Hi everyone, my name is Linda and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Linda.
I want to thank Dale for inviting me up here and thanks for the beautiful ride up here. It's absolutely gorgeous. I'm coming up from Waynesboro and it was just such a lovely drive up here. And you know, when he asked me to speak, he gave me some like requirements, you know, of like what the group expects and what to do and this kind of stuff. And I found it like so I was so enchanted by that because I don't know about you, but I walk around a lot and I see a lot of people like getting and staying sober incorrectly. And it's just like, how is this happening? You have to have a structure and you have to have all this stuff and you have to do all these things and you have and you know and and it's you know what you're working with, okay? You know, I must have this thing. And when he wrote the other day that you know he followed these last couple of paragraphs and I was like, I don't know if I know what it says on page 29. And I went to my big book and make sure that I read it. And I was like, oh, I get it. You know, I get it now. I must have this thing. And so when I got sober, the year was 1989 and I was 22 years old and my life was a dumpster fire. It was an absolute dumpster fire. And I didn't know that. If you had asked me at the time, I'd have told you I was fine. Everything was fine. I was a high school dropout. I actually got thrown out of eighth grade. I never finished the ninth grade. I had two little kids. I was not married. I had been divorced. I had, you know, multiple boyfriends and whatnot. And I was living on welfare in government housing in a little town called Fostoria, Ohio, which is nowhere. And that's where I had gone for my geographical here, yet another one. I like to move. It's a, I have a long history of moving. I think this is my fifth state, and my third since being sober. And you know, because I've, you know, I mean, someplace else is better. Someplace else is always better. And so when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was a wreck. I was just hopeless. I just didn't know what else to do. And I had the party had been over for me for a long time at 22. Which is, I'm so jealous of people that have these long, really exciting drinking stories. I don't know if I should be jealous of you, but I feel that way. I feel like, gosh, they got to have all the good stuff, you know, but my life just crashed and burned. You know, I started drinking, I was like 8 or 9 years old, you know, and we were stealing cigarettes and stealing beer and going out into the woods. And I look, you know, I work with small children now, and I mean, shouldn't you be at home with like some animal crackers and a juice box? I mean, it's just like, I just can't get over it. But that's what we were doing. Like I came out like kicking and screaming and fighting, you know, and I had all the normal things that alcoholics do. You know, we all feel so isolated and alone and awkward and weird and all, you know, and all the things that, you know, truthfully, I think everybody feels that way. I don't think that we have a particular alcoholic mind. I don't think I do. I think I am painfully immature. I think that my expectations of life far exceed any normal expectation. I think everything should be wonderful and everybody should love me and things should always go my way. And it should, if I ask for something and I, you know, say please, you know, everything should unfold that way. And I should get instant gratification just all the time. And that's how I just kind of came out. I don't know where that came from, but that's just how I've always been. You know, I don't understand what's not fair. You know, someone has more than I do, and someone gets to do this. And you know, it's just, it's endless. And I did not come from an impoverished home. You know, I went up to Boston. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts, and my family literally came over on the Mayflower. I mean, I come from a long, old family in New England. You know, there's streets named after people. They were, you know, in politics and they were owned land and they were prominent people. You know, and I come from a long line. All my parents are both Ivy League graduates. You know, there wasn't anything like impoverished about my childhood, certainly not materialistically. You know, I went to the doctor. I went to the dentist every 6 months. I had shoes on my feet. We went to good schools and we went on vacations. There wasn't anything that really should have triggered this idea that I did not have enough. But I always felt like I didn't have enough. I always wanted to feel different than how I felt right from the get-go. And it wasn't a particularly happy home. You know, alcoholism, it doesn't really understand demographics. It just is there. It's just always there. You know, whether you're rich or poor or whatever, it just shows up. like every other thing in life, it just shows up because it's not fair. And so it was not a happy home, but it wasn't the worst home. I have an older brother and an older sister. Neither of them are in the rooms at Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe one of them should be. But certainly there's some problems going on, right? It was not a happy home. My parents did not seem to be particularly happy about being parents. I think at that time frame, you just like got married and had kids because you had to get married and have kids. Like that was just, what else would you do? People would think you were weird, And so I think that's just what they did. And I don't think they were real crazy about the idea. At least they didn't really act like it. But that's all right. I wasn't the worst home. I mean, people have done a lot worse in life and been pretty good. But that was not my destiny. And so, by the time I was eight, we were stealing liquor and stealing cigarettes and hiding in the woods and doing all the things that we really should not have been doing. And party favors came soon after that. And I was a bright kid. I didn't have any kind of like, no problems in school. Just had, just show up and do stuff, right? It's not a big deal. I was always pretty good at getting grades. But things started to crash and burn particularly hard in that family when we moved. My family did its own geographical cure. Maybe that's where I get it from. And they moved from Boston down to Florida, where things would be better, because it's so sunny and there's no snow. And we know now that like it being sunny and not having snow does not actually make you happy. It will not fix a bad marriage. It will not fix anything. You just won't have to shovel snow and you'll have a lot more sunshine, which is true. And so things got really ugly, and by the time I was in sixth grade, things were really getting bad. And I didn't know I had any kind of a problem. To be honest, I didn't know that everybody wasn't doing what I was doing. It just never occurred to me that that would be an issue. That didn't really stop me in any way from like running through life. And by the time I think it started to catch up with me. I think that I had a lot of depression. Surprise, surprise, alcohol is a depressant. I don't know what that does to children's bodies, but it wasn't good for me. And so by the time I was like sixth, seventh, eighth grade, middle school was a disaster. And I got thrown out of eighth grade because, you started to find some people that wanted to do things like I wanted to do things, and I started to find some family situations where I could like navigate that a lot easier because I was willing to lie, cheat, and steal to protect my drink. I always was. I didn't call it lying, cheating, or stealing. I always had nicer names for it, because you don't want to upset people and you still want to go and do what you need to do and you want to impress your friends and you have all this, I have all this stuff going on and I don't want to, it's just easier this way, really. And so I never called things like what they actually were. But the truth is, I was a liar and I was a cheater and I was a thief right from the get-go. And so by the time I was in eighth grade, we came to school in eighth grade, me and some friends of mine. I think three of them were also in the rooms at some point. And we came to school just trashed. I'm not sure why it was that we decided to come to eighth grade drunk, but we did. And surprisingly enough, it didn't go well. Because here, other people can tell when you're drunk. Who knew, right? I mean, I didn't know. I was always drunk, so I didn't know other, I didn't, you don't know, right? You don't know. I didn't know. And so, and we got in some trouble for that, and we got thrown out of that school. And hopefully I'll remember later on, or we'll come to me and have some really funny stories about that. But and so I went off and I went to high school for a while, and that didn't work out well. Surprise. And so I decided that what I needed to do was go away to school. And if I went away to school to get away from this crazy family, then life would be better. And so I convinced my parents to send me to school in New York. And I went to school in New York. And not surprisingly, that did not go well either because I fundamentally cannot follow directions. Like I just can't. And I've mastered this art of being contrary. So if you say up, I say down, you say left, I say right, you say right, I say wrong. It's just incessant with me. I just cannot follow the most basic instructions. And so, me and my boyfriend, we stole a car and forged a check and went off to go to California, where certainly things would be better. We got as far as West Virginia, which is because, I can't finish a project like nobody's business. Yeah, I just can't get anything done. All my ideas in life, I'm going to join this club and I'm going to do this, and I can't get any traction. I can't finish anything. And it's not that I don't mean what I say, because I do. I honestly do. When I'm lying to you to your face and maybe crying a little bit in the process, it's not that I don't mean it, because I do. It's that I fundamentally cannot finish it. And I don't know why. Other people are going to school. Other people are joining clubs. Other people are showing up when they're supposed to. Other people seem to be able to have that knack of navigating life and making it work. And I don't. And I don't know why. I can't figure it out. I never could figure it out. And I'm just tearing through life. I'm killing my parents. I'm killing my grandparents. It's not that people didn't try to help me, they did. But that's not the help I wanted. The help I wanted looked like money. The help that I wanted looked like you just let me do what I want and don't ask any questions. That's the kind of help I want. I just want you to tell me that you love me, but don't expect me to show up and do anything about it. I don't want to participate. I just want to do what I want to do. That's the help I want. Oh, we'll get you a doctor. We'll get you a shrink. Maybe we go to church. I don't know. I don't want that kind of help. And I was fairly young, and my mother was telling me that I was an alcoholic. And it was like, she started going to this Al-Anon thing. And she thought everybody was an alcoholic. I mean, it was exhausting. Obviously, that was not the problem. I mean, anybody could tell that. And so it didn't take long. I was 16 at this point. I got pregnant with my oldest child. And the boyfriend at the time was like, listen, peace out. So he hits the road to go back up north. I'm stuck because now I'm back in Florida. I'm not even sure how that happened because I was in West Virginia, but somehow I ended up in Florida again. And I was having a problem because now I'm pregnant. And this will solve it. Now we'll be fine. This will be great. This will be super because kids do that for you. Because again, my expectations of life were so twisted and so warped. I didn't have a clue. I did not have a clue. I was just painfully immature and childish. And so I ended up getting married and moving to West Palm Beach. And there's this really unique thing that happens in Florida in the 80s. If you have some money and you have some alcohol, you start getting introduced to some really crazy party favors that will help you to drink more. And that is, as far as I'm concerned, the only purpose in them. And we engage in all kinds of fun things. Where my daughter was, I can't even tell you. I don't know where I left. I just left her with anyone. I mean, I just left her with anyone. I don't even know. I was thinking about that earlier today. It's like, I don't know where she was when that happened. I don't know. And somehow, it turns out, so I'm in Florida and this is like turning awful and the cops and the drinking and the drugs and the, DSS and just, I mean, it's just a train wreck. It is a catastrophe. And my mother came over and she's sitting down with me to try to help me with like a budget. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? Like, that's not my problem. That's not, what are you even saying to me? It's this job and this guy and this kid and this apartment, and I don't even know what. It's just not that. Because again, that's not the help I wanted. And so I ended up leaving Florida and moving to Ohio. Now, I don't know if you've been to the middle of Ohio. Only an alcoholic would find that your geographical cure. Only, I mean, really. It's like, I was listening to the Joe and Charlie tapes, and he said, only an alcoholic, he was talking about Christopher Columbus, and only an alcoholic would sail west to go east, and get a woman to finance it. I laugh every time I hear it. It's like, because I identify. And so I ended up in Ohio, just nowhere. And once again, girl meets boy, I end up getting pregnant again by this guy, and we are just rip-roaring through. I mean, it is a dumpster fire. It's just so bad. At this point, I had gotten my GED because I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to make something of myself. I'm going to pull it together. I'm going to pull it together. How I'm going to pull it together, I don't actually know, but I'm going to pull it together this time. This time I mean it. And somehow I ended up in the same pile of crap. And now I'm alone, pregnant again, which I swore I would never do again. And my family is done with me. The guy is done with me. I ran out of friends and enemies right about the same week. And there wasn't a single person on this planet that wasn't like, you know what, whatever it is you're going to do, why don't you just go do it somewhere else? Because we're done here. We're just done. And I was done too. And I didn't know what to do. And I didn't know what the problem was. And I sure as hell didn't know how to fix it. And I was sitting in, in that point, this is how my alcoholic end looked like. The party was over. I'm alone in this house, in this like just awful house. I'm renting this house for like $200 a month. And even in 1988, that was a dump. And I'm thinking, I'm in like, oh, this looks like a middle class neighborhood. And a friend of mine, I remember her telling me, he's like, this is not a middle class neighborhood. Like, I don't know what you're thinking. I'm delusional. I am delusional. I couldn't see the truth if it walked up and slapped me. And I think it did a few times. I couldn't see it. I wasn't in denial. I wasn't lying about it. I was delusional. I didn't know what the truth was. And I was reading this book and I'm, laying in bed crying, miseries, remorse, self-pity. Oh my God. And I'm reading this book and it's not an AA approved literature, but the book was like, listen, if this is like the characteristics of your life, you need to go to a 12-step meeting. Like you need to go to a 12. I didn't, I, you know, I was, I mean, what else are you going to do? There was nowhere else for me to go. Probably need Al-Anon. You probably need some, you got all this crazy stuff happening. You need a 12-step meeting. And I didn't know what that meant, but the book used language that I could hear, that I could identify with, that made sense to me in a way that other things did not make sense to me. And I could start to get a glimmer that maybe there was some hope. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what that was going to look like. But I ended up going to this Al-Anon meeting, and in this Al-Anon meeting, they were good Al-Anons, and they said to everybody, you should always go to AA. Everybody in Al-Anon should go to Alcoholics Anonymous, go to the speaker meetings, and hear what people are talking about. You should go and hear what that language looks like, And it was really weird, and I decided I was going to go to this meeting, and. I didn't know what to expect. I thought, man, there's going to be alcoholics there. And I don't know what that looked like. It's going to be really creepy. And I was 22 years old, so I got all dressed up to go to the meeting, as one does. And I went to this meeting, and it was in the St. Gwendolyn's Church, like all good meetings are. And it was in the basement, as they all are. And it was huge. It was probably 200 people. It was a Monday night meeting. It was an enormous speaker meeting. And they have a little practice back in the day that the goal was to get there early. And I didn't know. Nobody told me. Because what happens is you come in the door and you have to shake every single person's hand before you can get your coffee and sit down. And I didn't know the language of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know the culture. I didn't know anything about it. I was scared to death. I mean, I was just shaking. It was a lot to take in. But and then people start shaking your hands and they do what they do. They do what we do here. We welcome you in. I don't know what your story is. I don't know what you look like. I don't know where you come from. It doesn't matter. Just come on in. We're going to shake your hand. We're going to tell you that you're welcome here. And they did. And I was shaking. I don't know where my kids were. I couldn't tell you. But I went to this meeting and I walked around and shook, and it was like shaking hands. And I was like, this is the craziest thing I've ever done in my life. And I did a lot of crazy things in my life. And I was going around the tables and stuff. And I went and sat down, and I can't tell you a single thing that that speaker talked about. I don't have a clue. I do not have a clue. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and I couldn't really relate to what he said. But I liked the way this room felt. I liked the way this room. Now, granted, I was also feeling like if you actually knew me, you wouldn't like me because nobody ever does. But I liked the way the room felt. And And it wasn't long before I was going to AA meetings pretty regularly. And then I found an AA boyfriend, so that made it easier immediately. And so, and that, because I was scary going to a meeting, but now I had someone to go with. And that made life a little bit easier for me. That was a culture that I understood. And so I was at this meeting, and I, it doesn't take that long if you identify with what people talk about in here. People talk about things that I was told you were never supposed to talk about. We never talk about stuff like that, ever. We never talk about what happens in our families. We never talk about how we feel. We certainly never talk about who we slept with. We never talk about the things we're ashamed of. We never talk about the time we're throwing up in the front yard or in the bed or in the, wherever. We never talk about lying, cheating, and stealing. We just never talk about it. Our culture was that we lie, even if they have it in your face. I don't care if you saw it, I'm still going to tell you you didn't. It's just who I am. And I came in here and I heard people talk about things about their loneliness and their isolation and the things that they had done. And I knew it was the truth. I had never heard people talk like that before. And I knew it was the truth. And I wanted what that was. I wanted to be able to talk to people about who I was without having to lie, cheat, steal, and deny it. I just wanted some of that. I wanted that level of comfortability. I didn't expect to actually get it, but I wanted that. It was very attractive to me. And it wasn't that long before I realized, it sounds like I'm a potential alcoholic. I mean, certainly I have some characteristics, but I'm so young. And I mean, these guys are old. I mean, they're like in their 30s. I mean, some of them are even older than that. Okay. Like, it's crazy. And I just figured, you know what I figured? I figured I just won't drink anymore. That's all. I mean, how hard is it? You just don't drink, right? I'll just go to these meetings and I just won't drink. How hard is it? And I found myself on a blind date. I found myself on this blind date and we were sitting around and I was, had already pledged, not going to drink anymore. Life is good. And the guy buys me a drink and I drink it. I just drank it. He bought me another one and I drank that one too. Strawberry daiquiris. I don't even like strawberries. Okay. And that was really one of my very first experiences of drinking against my will. I didn't want to drink. I said I wasn't going to drink and I meant it. And I was drinking anyway. And it was like something, it was just like something kind of cracked and broke inside of me. And I knew I was done. I knew there just wasn't any denying this anymore. That maybe this actually was my problem, was that I was an alcoholic. And that once I start drinking alcohol, I have no way of knowing how that's going to end. And once I quit, I have no way of keeping quit. And I knew that was me. And it was a relief and also really, really scary. And I went to a meeting not long after this big book meeting. And we were sitting around this table, and the clubhouse in Little Foster, Ohio, that time was called Dry Haven, and it was on the second floor of this building, and the floor was like dipping inward. It was just kind of falling apart. I mean, it was just it was. It, I'm sure the building was condemned. I mean, isn't that where they put alcoholics? And so it was just like so this, and it was rough, and everybody smoked then, of course. And it was the windows upstairs. I don't think windows open. And it was like a Cheech and Chong movie. I mean, the smoke was just so thick. And when you come out of there, it was just crazy. And I remember being up there and I was sitting next to this guy. And I had not been to a meeting like this before. I'd only gone to speaker meetings. And they went around the room and introduced themselves. Hey, I'm Joe. And I'm like, oh, I'm Tim. And I'm Sarah. And I was counting and I was just like, I was paralyzed with fear. I mean, I was shaking and I was sweating, like sweat was pouring. I could feel it. And I was sitting there and I was counting down to when it got to me. And I'm going to tell you, it never occurred to me to just get up and leave the table, which seems like the most normal thing in the world. I mean, today it's like, why didn't you get up? I was glued to that chair. I could not get out of that chair if my life had depended upon me, and I was terrified. And it got around the room to me, and I was shaking and I was sweating, and I said, "My name is Linda, and I'm an alcoholic." And they said, "Hi, Linda," and the next person went. And it was this moment in time that was so precious because I didn't know what was going to happen. I had no idea that that moment in time would dictate the next 34 years of my life and hopefully the rest of my life. I had no idea what had just happened. Just like no one does when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. You know, all the things that I thought I wanted in my life, I had no idea what was going to actually happen there, or that I would someday be happy and be free. I had no idea. And I haven't taken a drink since that time in August, September of 1989. And I'd like to say that, oh, I just got into recovery and I just did everything they told me to do and it was really wonderful and all that. I don't follow directions well. I think I've been clear on that. I'm not a good direction follower. And they said things like, well, you should, ask God for help in the morning and thank him at night. It was like, well, I don't believe in God because God hates me. And it's not going to work out for me. And I'm just going to go to these meetings and not drink. And they said, you should get a sponsor. And well, I'm definitely not getting a sponsor because that's weird. And I'm not doing that. And I'm super cool. And they said, all the list of things they say to do. And I said, no, but I'm going to go to meetings and hang out with this guy. And I was about 4 months sober. And if it was just an issue of not drinking, if that's what the problem was, is well, we just won't drink, we wouldn't be in these meetings. I wouldn't sponsor people. I wouldn't contribute to my home group. I wouldn't be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous if it was just not drinking. I know someone who was just a heavy drinker. You know what? He just doesn't really drink anymore. Every once in a while, he has a beer. And that's it. And his life is good. And he never thinks about it. But I'm an alcoholic. And left to my own devices, it's all I think about. And at 4 months sober, I was out of my mind because just not drinking feels like prison time. Every day is just the most endless drudgery, misery. I can't even explain it. It was horrible every day, and I didn't know what to do. And finally, I called. This woman gave me her number at some point, and she said, "Listen, if it gets, this is my home number. We didn't have cell phones. This is my home number, and this is my work number. And if it gets really bad, you can call me at work." And I was like, "Okay, I mean, I'm not gonna call her. That's crazy talk." But sure, okay, I'm fine. And so, and isn't it interesting that we know when you're crazy? Like, I wouldn't tell anybody how long I'd been sober because I didn't want them to know I was a newcomer. I'm pretty sure if I knew I was a newcomer. He's pretty sure. Pretty sure they could tell, like, she crazy over there. And some of these people, I mean, it's a small town. Like, it's not like they didn't know anybody. And she gave me her number, and I pulled this number out of wherever it was, and I called her at work, I didn't have to explain to her what was happening. I didn't have to tell her because she knew. And she said, "Sweetie, you're going to have to get on your knees and ask God for help. You're just going to have to." And I was like, "That's not what I wanted to hear. That's not the help I wanted at all." Once again, was desperate and thinking, you know what? Why not? And so I locked all the doors and closed all the windows and I went upstairs in my bedroom and closed all the and I locked the door. I lived alone. And so I got on my knees and I asked a God I didn't believe in to help me. Just to help me. I don't know what that looks like, but I'm gonna need some help. And it made me a little bit more malleable. And this woman came up to me and she said, "I'm gonna be your sponsor, okay? I'm just going to be your sponsor, and we're going to do this 4-step thing, and we're going to get through some step work." And little by slow, things started to get a little bit better. It became a little more palatable. Life became a little bit less painful just to wake up in the morning, just a little bit better. And And I got married early in recovery. We had a couple more kids, moved to Florida, as always. And so, and things didn't turn out well for me at that point. I ended up not hitting going to meetings anymore because I got sober and I got a life and I got busy. I'm just too busy, and I was busy, but I'm too busy to go to meetings. And it wasn't that long before, he went back out drinking and life started to turn into a dumpster fire again. And I am stone cold sober. It's not the alcohol. Certainly, I can't do anything if I'm drinking. But for this girl, it's not the alcohol. I am delusional. I always think I'm right. I always think I have the answers, and I always think I don't need help. And when that turned to absolute disaster, and it turned to disaster, because my best that I bring to the table without Alcoholics Anonymous, without God of my understanding, without anything else, I am running the show and I'm explaining to you how you're wrong. And my husband is drunk and he's off doing this and he's off doing that. And you know what happens? What I found out in my fourth step, when you hurt me, when I feel like you have done me dirty, I get revenge. That's just who I am. I'm going to cut you. That's just who I am. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that until years later. So now he's out drinking. We're both having affairs. I've got to file for bankruptcy. I can't get him out of the house. I don't know what's going to happen. The cops are here. The kids are over here. It's a disaster. It's a dumpster fire again. It is painful. My father's passed away. My mother's watching this mess. My family's just like, what is happening? What is happening? And I am stone cold sober. And people are saying things like, just do the next right thing. I feel like I'm doing the next right thing. I went back to meetings. I got a sponsor. I'm doing this work, and I just can't stand it anymore. And I'm double digit recovery, and I cannot stand it anymore. And then I met this guy, and he says to me, he says, "You need to go join the Big Book Step Study. You need to go to Big Book Step Study, and you need to get a Big Book Step Study sponsor, and you need to clear the wreckage of your past." Now, I've done four steps before. I've done step work. I've had sponsors. I did, all the right things. And I met with this woman, and she said, so what are you looking for here? What's going on with you? And I looked at her and I said, I don't want to live anymore. I can't do this anymore. If this is sober, I just can't do it. I cannot live like this. And I don't know what to do. And she introduced me to this world of Big Book Step Study. And we went through the steps and we read the doctor's opinion and we read Bill's story and we read this as there is a solution. And we sat down and read page by page and we went through it. And we talked about what the first step means. And we talked about being powerless over alcohol. But we also talked a long time about what it means to be unmanageable. And she said, if your life isn't where you want it to be, if this isn't looking like what you thought you should be at your age, who is managing your life? It's not you, is it? And it certainly isn't God, because he never had this plan for you. So what is it that's running your life that you're here at 10 years sober? And then we read probably the most inspirational chapter of all in the big book for me, We Agnostics. And we talked about the second step and what that means, to come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, at this point, I've always been really confused about this. Oh, well, just choose a God of your own understanding. Well, either God is or he isn't. I mean, if it is God, we grow up with a notion of what God is in some form of religion, at least I did. Not a super religious family, but we have this idea that this is God. You can't just change it. I mean, that just doesn't work. And since I've always asked God for things and I've never gotten what I thought I should get, if he does exist, he doesn't like me a whole lot. And therefore, I am certainly not going to be asking him for anything else because look at this dumpster fire. And so it's just been a challenge for me. This was hard for me to get my head around. This would cause me a lot of pain and a lot of struggle. And we read this through, and I've read the big book before at different times, but here we went through it and we talked about it together, we read it together, and we hit our knees together and we asked God for help. And we have a really powerful prayer, and it's called the set-aside prayer. And if you're not familiar with it, it goes along the lines of God, help me to set aside everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, everything I think I know about you, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, so that I can have an open mind and a new experience with these things. And it was powerful to me. And we read We Agnostics, and it talked about, the warring nations and people. And it hasn't changed. People are still out there trying to kill each other. We still have all the problems in the world. We still have all of this. We also have moments of great beauty and great kindness and great grace. And it talked about how the fundamental idea of God resides in each man, woman, and child, regardless of where you are or who you are or where you come from. And I felt that. I've seen some amazing things in my life. I've scuba dived in the oceans, I've climbed mountains, I've seen babies born. I've done some amazing things where I felt the presence of God, unquestionably. And that little paragraph in there just hit me. And I could accept that I don't know what this God is. I don't know. But I have some hope. And something has to help me because I cannot do this by myself. I just can't. And then we got to the third step. And the third step talked about, and how it works. And it talked about, turning our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand Him. Well, I don't have a God that I understand. I think there's probably one, but I don't understand it. And if I turn my will and my life over, what will happen to me? What will become of me if I do that? And the answer, of course, is, sweetie, what becomes of you is not up to you. It never was up to you. And when you did try to run it yourself, look at where you are. And that was irrefutable to me, because here I am. I don't want to live anymore. I've got four little kids at home. Now I have a college degree. Now I have a house and a car and a profession. And I feel worse than, I mean, to me, I felt worse than I did when I got here. Because just not drinking is not the answer. And then we sat down to do the fourth step, and she said, get some notebooks. And we're going to sit down and we're going to start. And we hit our knees and we said the third step prayer. And we started writing. And I started my resentment list. And resentments, you shouldn't, I want to write a novel because I need to explain to you how they've done me dirty. I mean, it's, you need the whole thing, right? Because there's a lot. No, we need 10 words or less. It's what we need. We need 10 words or less, just like in the big book. We don't need your paragraphs. Thanks. You can tell me about that later. And then we sat down to write the turnarounds. And I can tell you, I never had this experience before of seeing how I was selfish, self-centered, dishonest, and frightened. What is the real truth? The real truth is I was jealous. The real truth is that I was resentful. The real truth is that it's none of my business. The real truth is that I don't know what the truth is. The real truth of going through those things was so powerful to me. I had light bulbs going off everywhere where all of a sudden I'm able to see things I never saw before. This process gave me information I didn't have. I've done four steps before, but they were more narrative. It didn't give me new information. It certainly didn't give me any tools to change my life. And this did. And then we got to the fear inventory. What are you afraid of? And this was hard. Because I'm really young and cool and I'm not afraid of anything. And I don't care what anybody thinks about me. And nothing could be further from the truth. I'm terrified of what other people think of me. I change everything about me because I'm thinking about what you think about me. Well, I lie through my teeth because I'm worried about what you're thinking about me. I'm worried that this God that I don't really understand doesn't like me anyway. I'm afraid these things that you tell me have happened to you in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous will not happen for me because I am fundamentally inferior. I'm afraid that I will never be worthy. I'm afraid I will never be right. I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, and I'm afraid. And I act as if those fears are true, and self-reliance yet again has failed me. What should I have done differently? Well, in some of the cases, I should have been at home doing my homework for sure. And in some of those cases, I should have trusted God. Not that everything will be okay, that everything is okay right here in this moment. And then we did the sex inventory. And I can tell you that was fraught with challenges for me because I didn't know what that meant, but it sounded a little too revealing for my taste. I thought we were gonna like write like who you slept with and what positions you use. I mean, I don't know what I had all kinds of like, oh my God. And that wasn't it at all. The big book asks us, was it selfish? Were you dishonest? Who did you hurt? And that was kind of like that next part of that four step, that turns into your eight step list. Who did I hurt? Where were my children? What were my parents thinking? When I'm sleeping with somebody else's man, who did you hurt? And that list of putting it out there and adding that in and going through it over and over again gave me information I didn't have before. And the truth did set me free. And then, the fifth step, which takes forever, by the way. I didn't have this moment of clarity, like, the book talks a lot about this like immediate freedom and all that. And I didn't feel that at all. I'm going to tell you, I just felt weird. So that was weird. And I'm really glad it's over. Oh. But that's okay. Because what I discovered over time is that it's almost like a windshield. You have this hard exterior just built up over time and circumstances. And that windshield shatters. But it doesn't shatter like a glass shatters. It cracks. And it starts to become a little malleable. If you've ever seen a shattered windshield, it almost bends. And that's what it felt in my heart and my soul. It felt like it was shifting. And it became a little bit kinder and a little bit more considerate and just a little bit bendable, just a little malleable. Whereas before it was just nothing but solid stone. And I'm convinced the six and seven step are so short because they're supposed to be. They're just supposed to be. I am willing that you have all this mess. I'm willing. I said my third step prayer and I meant it. I'm willing. And I'm going to ask you to remove them. And that's it. I don't have to work on my six and seven step. I mean, look what happens when I work on my life. Look at it. I'm not supposed to be working on my character defects. I don't have the ability to fix them. If I did, I'd have already done it, wouldn't I? Because God knows I tried. So I'm going to ask. I'm going to be willing and I'm going to ask. And the ninth step, we went back through that list, which was formidable. And we started circling like five at a time. And let's go hit them up. Let's go talk about it. And she gave me a little script. And she said, you're gonna ask to meet with people to have a few moments of their time. And you're gonna ask if you can talk to them. Sometimes it's appropriate to tell them that you're an alcoholic, sometimes it's not. But it goes something along the lines of, I've had an opportunity to reflect upon our relationship in the past. And I need to tell you that I was wrong and that I'm sorry. I was inconsiderate. And I was dishonest and I was disrespectful. Maybe I stole from you. Maybe I stole your peace of mind. Maybe I wasn't being respectful of your space. The list is pretty, it's extensive. I don't know. And then is there anything else? And I've only had one person basically tell me to like eat it and die. Only one, which is impressive, really. Every time, they just like, I mean, people just cry. People, they just want to be recognized. They just want the truth. That's all. People don't need or want that much. They just want that connection. And I had to tell the employer once, I didn't want to come because it really just guts. And I had to call him and I had to talk to him about this and I had to tell him that I was insubordinate. and I was disrespectful and that I was wrong and I didn't treat him well at work, you know, and that I was guilty of character assassination. You know, and he was just, and it's always the same. It's like, well, you don't have to worry about that. That's, you know, it's water under the bridge. It's okay. It's okay every time. And every time the freedom that I experience is not when they answer the phone. It's not when I get done with it. It's when I make the phone call. The freedom comes in the effort. Just like the faith and the trust and the love that I have for a God I still don't understand doesn't come in finding him. It comes in the seeking. And the freedom, the promises of the ninth step come because I make the effort to make the amends. Not necessarily because anything magical happens. They might give me a hug. They might tell me it's okay. They might cry. They might throw me out. I don't know. That's not the magic. The magic came in the effort. And the magic came in that relationship that I'm able to have with people because I'm just honest. It's awful being lied to. People lie to me. I act like I'm dying. I lie to you. I'm like, get over it. People don't get over it until you own up, until I own up to it. It's a powerful, powerful experience. And 10, 11, and 12, I'm grateful to say that I live a really healthy program today. You know, wasn't that long. It was last fall, last August. Oh my gosh, things were crazy at work and all the stuff was going on. And this woman made a decision without consulting me, and it really messed up. Like, it was just a disaster of a week at work. Things were going crazy. And I completely lost my mind with this poor woman and like was practically yelling at her. Where did this come from? I was like a crazy person, you know, not quite as crazy as I used to be, but you know, it was up there. It was not my usual demeanor as I walked through the world. And she was obviously very upset, you know, and it was pointed out to me by another worker. It's like, you know, everybody's working hard here. Everybody's working hard. You know, and I had to go and make amends. And I didn't want to send her an email because I felt like that was copping out, you know, and I didn't want to send her a text. And I waited till the next weekday. Unfortunately, she had like several, you know, she had overnight to think about what a jerk I was, and to really work this up. And she was right and I was wrong. You know, and I had to make amends and I had to tell her that I was wrong and that I was really sorry and I really treated her poorly. And that it also had nothing to do with her. She's just in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, isn't that life? It's not personal. My parents weren't mean to us because it's personal. Could have been anybody. I just happened to be there. I was driving here today. This guy in a truck was a crazy person. It's not personal. You know, I'm just in the splash zone. You know, this woman was just in the splash zone. I was having a really crappy day, you know, and I forgot that it's just not important, that everything is okay. It's just all okay. Just doesn't even matter, you know. And I let the circumstances get on top of me. And I lost my temper and I was wrong. You know, and we're fine today. I mean, yeah, I had to quit my job over that because I wouldn't have been able to face her. You know, I'd have been sabotaging her all the time and she'd have been doing it to me most likely. I mean, it would have been a disaster. We never would have been able to work together. I never would have been able to stay at that job just by making amends, just by saying I was sorry, just by owning it, you know? I practice prayer and meditation regularly. I pray every day. I'm not a fantastic meditator, but I am told that you cannot stay sober long term on 11 and a half steps, that you have to do all of them. And so I meditate. I try very hard. I never get any like life-changing thing happening to me when I meditate. Like I never, like the clouds don't open and whatever. But what I will tell you is that when I practice meditation, other times, moments of clarity come to me that wouldn't have before. You know, and I think about it, it's like, and I'm sitting there and I'll be doing something, and all of a sudden I'll make a different decision than I would normally have made. You know, and I can, and not, it doesn't always happen that way, but just like these moments in time, like, you know, when I'm driving in traffic, because, you know, they don't call us assholes for nothing, right? I mean, I'm driving in traffic. You bring it on, I am here for it. I mean, I'm a crazy person behind the wheel, or I used to be, right? And so, you know, but these moments in time when it's like, that's a terrible idea. Or, you know what? Maybe that guy's just having a bad day. Like it comes intuitively, not because I have to think about it. And I feel like that's because of meditation, because I've asked. You know, because I've asked, not because I've tried to fix my own problems, because I cannot, but because I've asked. And I'm very active in my 12 step. You know, I've started several meetings down in the Waynesboro area. They're going really well. I have a prison correspondence woman that I work with. I sponsor a bunch of people. I am sponsored regularly. I meet with people all the time, every week. Typically, I meet with sponsees. And we go through the steps of the big book, you know, and we work really, really hard at that. I contribute to GSO. I contribute in the seventh tradition. I was told that just because you can get something for free doesn't mean you should get something for free, that you should pay for what you get. Because after all, what is it that I have that didn't come as the direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous? I have nothing. Look at me when I got here. I have nothing. And I live a very comfortable life today. You know, I used to think that, I mean, I would see people, you know, you see these old couples in the grocery store and they're walking around together buying peas or whatever. And they're, you know, and they're not complaining to each other and they're not talking smack about each other and they're not complaining. They're just like, they look really cute, right? And I used to hate them. Oh, so jealous. You know, and I'm married today to this great guy, and we go to the grocery store and talk about the price of peas or whatever. And you know, we just have this really, really sweet relationship. You know, we've been married 22 years now, and we're just really happy. And we live below our means in a little house with a little garden and some chickens, and our kids come, and we just have this really, really sweet life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember I was early in recovery and I opened up a, I think a big book on one of the tables and there was a little note that was stuck inside there. And it said, was handwritten and it said, I have survived against impossible odds until today. I will survive the next 24 hours for I am no longer alone. Naturally, I stole that. But I've kept it because I am no longer alone. Thanks to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the God I don't really understand, and meetings just like this. Thank you so much for letting me share.